This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we're going to start our show with a discussion about FirstLink, which is a 211 referral center that is headquartered in Fargo but serves the entire state of North Dakota. And we're going to talk about a particular emphasis for FirstLink today with Ashley Ladbury-Herchena. She's the FirstLink Training and Educational Coordinator. She joins us right here in studio. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is 211?
Yeah, so 211 is a number that people can call to get access to information about community resources. And actually, about 98% of the United States has access to 211 if they dial it. And it's based on your location. So if you're in Fargo or North Dakota or Clay County, Minnesota, and you dial 211, you're going to come to the call center at FirstLink.
So this is a referral center. So what kinds of referrals are we talking about?
So all different types of services. Our most common needs that people are calling for are typically related to basic needs. So things like rent payment assistance, electric payment assistance, transportation, gas, bus tickets, things like that. But we also get a lot of people looking for information on mental health, behavioral health type services. So addiction treatment, counseling, whether it's, you know, a counselor they want to see once a week or they need more in-depth care that's, you know, requiring maybe a stay at a hospital or a treatment center or something like that.
So who works there?
So we have kind of a variety of staff, and we're 24 hours a day. And in order to work there, people do have to be 18 or older and have graduated from high school. That's kind of the basic requirements. But I would say most of our staff are either interested in going into the counseling field. So we have some students that are working, and then we have other staff that really from a variety of backgrounds, really. But kind of the underlying interest is they want to help people.
Well, you are doing all these various referrals for various purposes, a pretty broad range of services.
Yes.
That you're providing. Yeah. So how are these people who answer the phone trained?
Yeah, so we have an in-depth training process. It takes anywhere between 6 weeks to 2 months for people to complete training. We have to do classroom training. Then we do kind of slowly letting people get their feet wet in the call center before they're out on their own. So it is a long process. And like you said, because we cover so many different areas, people have to have knowledge, not necessarily just in housing, but in housing and healthcare and mental health and all these other things.
How many people work there?
So I think it's close to 25. We kind of fluctuate back and forth right around 25.
So in
staff total.
24 hours a day, so you were always answering the phone.
That's right.
It.
Yep.
Where are you physically located?
Well, so our office is in the Fargo-Moorhead area. We don't disclose the location of the call center just for security reasons.
Okay. So what kinds of calls are most common?
Yeah, so most common and it actually kind of – we have a difference between day and evening. So during the day, it's mostly referral calls. So people looking for information on places that can help them, whether it's financial assistance or mental health care or a variety of different needs. And then in the evening, we tend to get more calls for another service we offer, which we call listening and support. So basically, if people are feeling really stressed out or they've had a bad day and they just need someone to talk to, they can give us a call. And those calls tend to happen more in the evening, overnight, and weekends.
And would those typically be people who might call more than once?
Sometimes, yep.
And do they occasionally require referral to 911?
That does happen sometimes, yeah. At FirstLink, we also answer the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, the 1-800-273-TALK number. And so probably most commonly when people call that number, they are looking for someone to talk to. They want to know where they can go to for help and we're there to help in those situations. But sometimes we do get calls, especially on the suicide line, that are more emergent in nature and we might need to connect someone to 911.
We're going to talk specifically about the suicide referral service and that in a moment here. But how aware do you think people are about the 211 service?
I think the general public is probably not very aware. I think maybe some people that might work in human services or, have maybe attended some of our trainings or, you know, might see us at different committee meetings or things like that might be more aware of us. But I think just the general public is not very aware about this resource.
Well, in a day long ago now, there was a phone book.
In the phone book, you could
have this prominent thing that said 211 for these kinds of services. So how do you get the word out there? besides having interviews like this.
Right. Yeah. So we try to do different trainings. We try to attend a lot of different kind of committee or coalition type meetings for a lot of different issues, partly because sometimes we're the initial referral service or the, you know, the first contact, that first link really to help. So we want, you know, all these different organizations to know about our services. And then like the 211 University, that was a big reason why we started doing that, was to help educate all different types of people about our service and how people could refer family or friends or clients or whoever they might be working with to our services.
So you're serving the entire state of North Dakota. Are there parts of the state that are particularly isolated or raise concerns of, about timely intervention, that kind of thing?
Yes, absolutely. The more rural areas, you know, especially when it comes to mental health care, every county in North Dakota is served by a human service center. But depending on where you are located, sometimes it's a drive. It's an hour or two just to get to that care. So, yeah, there are certainly more rural areas that have a difficult time accessing care.
Well, we were particularly interested in talking to you today because of this focus on suicide prevention and about a mental health first aid course that you're going to be offering. So let's get into that. Talk about the mental health first aid course first.
Yeah, so mental health first aid is an 8-hour standardized training. It actually originated, the concept started in Australia almost 20 years ago now and came to the United States in 2008. And here in the U.S., it's overseen by the National Council for Behavioral Health. About 7 years ago, I became a trainer. So since then, First Link has been offering it in North Dakota. And so, yeah, it teaches just kind of an overview of, you know, the information related to prevalence. So like how common are mental health conditions within adults in the United States?
Quite common.
Quite common. Yes. Yeah, exactly. About 1 in 5 U.S. adults deal with a mental health condition every year. And then we kind of look at some of the most common conditions and look at signs, symptoms, but also crises that might be associated with that, whether it's like a panic attack or thoughts of suicide, and then how a person can intervene to provide kind of initial assistance, just in the same way that you do with like physical first aid. You know, how can you kind of help stabilize the person until other help arrives?
And how is this coursework delivered?
So it has to be done in person. So no, ITV or any kind of thing like that. It has to be done in person.
So that keeps you pretty busy?
It sure does, yeah.
Let's talk about the 211 University.
Yep.
What does that involve?
So we've only had one 211 University that we've done. We have another one that's coming up April 18th, and it's an hour course for people to learn how they might be able to refer people they know to First Link, so like the types of services that we provide, but also our resource database is available on our website. And the way that you can search, I think, is very user-friendly, but it has some kind of idiosyncrasies that if you don't know about them can make it less user-friendly. So that was kind of our main goal, was just to show people how they can use the resource database that's online.
So you have more than just the 211 number. You've got a website as well.
Yes, we do. Yep.
What's the website address?
It is myfirstlink.org.
Very good. Myfirstlink.org.
Yep.
And what resources does it offer to somebody who goes up there?
Yeah, so it has all the same information that we have at the database that we use at the call center, but it's structured in a way that makes it pretty easy to use. So, you know, if you're looking for food, there's just a little icon that says food, and you click on that, and it gives you other options. So, you know, are you looking for like food stamps? Are you looking for a food pantry? Are you looking for even like growing your own food, like a community garden? And so then you can pick what it is that you're looking for, and we'll give you resources.
That's a lot of variety. That must be a pretty big website.
It is. Yeah, it's a big job to keep everything updated as well, because we have to one of our criteria from an organization that is like our accrediting agency is that we have to update every agency every year. And we have about 5,500 resources in the database. So it's a big job.
You mentioned this National Suicide Hotline, 1-800-273-TALK.
Yep.
What happens when you get a call to 211 that raises that kind of concern.
So with the calls, whether it comes in on the 211 helpline or the suicide lifeline, they're answered in the same way. It's just basically a different light that rings on the phone. And so they're all handled in the same way. And sometimes people do call 211 instead of the 1-800 number because it's easier to remember for people. Mm-hmm. And that is perfectly okay. We can take those calls on 211 as well.
So can you describe for us in general terms what happens when you get a call like that?
Sure. So when people call... I mean, of course, every call is different.
Yes.
Sometimes when people call, they are just ready to talk about their situation right out the gate, and they, you know exactly what they want to talk about and what they want to say. And sometimes when people call, it's more just kind of this general feeling of, I just don't know what to do. I know I need help. And so sometimes we end up asking a little, like the call specialist ends up asking more questions just to kind of get a better idea of the situation, what that person's dealing with. You know, are there any things they've already tried? Have they already tried reaching out for help? And then so a lot of it is really kind of driven by the caller and what they need.
Well, I would imagine that at some point perhaps there's a caller who's on the brink and maybe the solution is to keep them on the phone for a while.
Sometimes that does happen. Yeah. And I think a lot of times we find, you know, the more people are able to stay on the phone and connect with the call specialist, it does help them to kind of feel more calm and, you know, and de-escalate. And so we have a lot of calls that start off with somebody more on the brink, and after talking, they're able to really, you know, decide that they do want to live and are, you know, available and open to help.
Do you go back and you check up on some of these people?
We can, yeah. So it's an option for the caller, but we do have a follow-up call program where we can give people a call back. Usually we try calling them back the next day, but then we can also continue to call them, you know, once a week, every other week, once a month, really kind of whatever works for them, just to offer more support.
How did you get involved in this line of work?
I mean, really, it was just like a lot of people that work at First Link. I really just wanted to be able to help people. I think that was the biggest thing, and especially related to mental health. When I was younger, I had some friends of mine that I was very close with that dealt with some mental health problems. And so it's kind of when I was thinking about applying, I thought, well, I guess, you know, if I could help somebody else, maybe I could help these people that are calling on the phone too.
So is First Link a career stop for people, or is it some, you know, is it a step in the direction of someplace else they want to work in or do?
I think it can be both. Yeah, there are some people that, you know, like I said, part of, you know, why they want to work at First Link is to get some experience, whether if they're going into like mental health counseling or something like that, you know, an area that requires more schooling. And for some people it is, you know, this is what they want to do.
Well, you've got 25 people working at First Link, and it's a 24-hour schedule, and you got a, you know, a state with 750,000 people in mm-hmm. Clay County as well. Should First Link be bigger?
Well, I think right now our staff kind of covers the call volume that we have, but I think if more people knew about First Link and maybe every person that needed help was actually calling, we would definitely have to be bigger.
So the challenge is making the awareness.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. How is 211 funded?
So we're funded a variety of ways. We get some funding from the state of North Dakota through like the Department of Human Services. We have really important relationships with local United Ways, both like United Way of Cass Clay, but also some of the other bigger communities around North Dakota as well. And then, you know, fundraisers, you know, grants, things like that we apply for.
Okay. So if you were to make the pitch for people to, you know, get some of this supporting information like the Mental Health First Aid or the 211 University, what should they do?
So if somebody wants to attend one of our trainings?
Yes.
Yeah, so they can go to our website, myfirstlink.org, and under the events page is where all of our events are listed and people can click the button to register. Some of the trainings do have a cost to them. The 211 University we do offer for free. So it, you know, just kind of depends on the training. And then also sometimes we are able to offer like mental health first aid or some of our other trainings for a free or reduced cost if they're sponsored by another agency. But all that will be on the website and people can take a look.
Do you take it to businesses? Do you large groups, that kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah, we have. So basically we try to do at least a couple every year that we just open up to the community. So, you know, anybody can come to the trainings. But lately especially, we've been getting a lot of requests for the mental health first aid from different organizations and businesses. So we also have a youth version of the training called Youth Mental Health First Aid that we've done for school systems. But then also I think one of my favorite examples of an organization that's had us do a mental health first aid for them was the Fargo Public Library. Like, it's a group of people that, I mean, they deal with people all the time, sometimes people dealing with mental health situations, but that's not what they went to school for. So that, you know, it's good for them to have some information and knowledge about the different conditions and how to provide support.
Might be particularly helpful in school environments, yes.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's a very interesting enterprise you're involved in, and obviously mm-hmm. one that touches some people in a very important way. It's important, I guess, to get that website out there again, myfirstlink.org, and that suicide national hotline, 1-800-273-TALK. Ashley Ladbury-Hirchina, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Coming up next on Main Street, a StoryCorps oral history.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Greetings, friends. I am Theodore Roosevelt. I have been gone 100 years. But I think it's just bully that I will be able to pop in once a week on this Grand Dakota Datebook series to share some of my thoughts. As you know, I have a special place in my heart for North Dakota, and I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you again. In all modesty, I had a great deal to say on many topics, and I earnestly hope you will find some value in my insights and ideas. So join me once a week on Dakota Datebook and sign up for the, what do you call it? Oh, yes, podcast.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Parents have hopes for their children, and health and happiness are at the top. For Loa Clement, health and happiness is not tied to things. She visited the StoryCorps mobile booth in Bismarck last July with her son Jason, and they shared their fears about the current political climate and the future of the environment.
We just seek self-satisfaction, and all of us, and we have this almost embarrassment of wealth. I mean, we fill our houses and our garages, and then we rent storage units and put plastic tubs in them, and it just is offensive. But I'm talking kind of about the American family in general. I just see excess. I don't think it's healthy. I see distractions and shallowness. I'm quite worried about the future of America, simply. Politically, I'm scared. I see idealism that has just fallen away. I see standards that are neglected, and I think it's really unhealthy. I was at UND from 66 to 70. It was the heart of racism, Vietnam War, women's equality, birth control pills. I felt like we gained ground, and maybe it's one step, two step forward, one step back. I don't know. I worry about your children and that generation. Things that should be valued are not. Honesty, integrity, how's that? Let's walk all over that. That just makes me deeply sad, and I don't know how we're going to lightly recover from that. How do you regain respect of basic sensitivity to other people? I mean, these are basic core values that are vital to societies. The other thing that I deplore is this degradation of the United States in the eyes of the world. We are losing allies and respect all around the world. These people are going, well, aren't they fools? I can just feel it and see it. These relationships were hard fought. To me, they represented an improving civilization for the whole planet. The environment is fragile, and we're ignoring it. We're denying science right now.
I worry. I mean, without some catastrophic type of upheaval in the way we treat our planet, there's just no way. It's just unsustainable. And nobody is willing to look past the next year, the next week. Nobody's willing to think about what it's going to be like 50 years down the road. They're so short-sighted and shallow. And I don't know if my children will have a planet to live on.
We may just be in the streets fighting for food.
I would like to think not. And I'm still optimistic. I mean, it's not like I'm hopeless. I think it's naive to think that we really understand far into the future, because there's so many opportunities for good things to happen. I mean, I know there'll be revolutions in terms of energy production and ways to, you know, to generate renewable resources that will give us a shot at, you know, making it through some of these things. So it's not like I want to give up hope, but God, it's terrifying.
I'm sorry we didn't do a better job in the 60s to get us further along this path. I'm sorry that we didn't make it better for you guys.
It's in all of us to focus on our needs in some sort of short-term sense. I mean, we all need to figure out where our next meal comes from. We're evolved to do that. But when you take 7 billion people or 9 billion or 20 billion and all focusing in that short-term way, it's something that the evolutionary traits that, you know, made us successful creatures are also ones that have the potential to doom us as a species. To some extent, the answers do lie in politics and policy and leadership, trying to help people make decisions that can put us on a sustainable path.
And we are essentially, as white Americans, we're the luckiest people on the planet.
Yeah.
We are what everybody else wants. And we're not, can't be too proud of what we've done, I don't think.
No. I am still optimistic. You know, you almost have to be. You can't give up hope. The world as a whole has to come to the reckoning that they're resources are finite and that the environment is fragile. And
even at work, why is it the 70-year-old that does a recycling? I want to sit him down and lecture him like I'm an old curmudgeon. For some reason, I hold back. Should I be braver?
That was Loa and Jason Clement. StoryCorps is a national initiative to record and collect personal stories. Excerpts from last summer's residency in Bismarck were selected and produced by Prairie Public, and this excerpt was edited by Ashley Thornburg. Our thanks to Basin Electric Power Cooperative for helping sponsor the StoryCorps visit to North Dakota.
To protect coastal cities from rising sea levels, you should hear what they're doing in Rotterdam.
The Dutch know what they're doing because they've been measuring the sea level for the longest.
And Nina Khrushcheva explains Putin's Russia.
Russia continues to understand itself in imperial terms. As all empires, they do think that they should be the most important ones in the world.
It's on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
Coming up on Main Street, a conversation with Max Green, the founder of Greenflower, an advocacy organization for medicinal and recreational marijuana. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Mandan police have identified the four people killed Monday in what police describe as a multiple homicide. But as Prairie Public's Dave Thompson reports, police do not yet have a suspect.
One of the four people killed, 52-year-old Robert Faulkner, was an owner of RJR Maintenance and Management, where the murders happened. The other three, 42-year-old Adam Fuhrer, 50-year-old William Cobb, and 45-year-old Lois Cobb, were RJR employees. Mandan Police Chief Jason Ziegler.
The investigation so far leads us to believe that this incident was specific to the victims. We do not believe the public at large is in any danger.
Ziegler said incidents of this kind are rare in Mandan and rare in the state of North Dakota.
It's really kind of surreal when you really think about it and you look at when a community goes through something like this. It's really something that you can't really imagine. And now comes trying to piece those questions together.
Ziegler is asking for the public's help. He says if people have video or have seen something they feel is suspicious, please contact Mandan Police. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
Exquisite. That's how officials with the National Weather Service describe the spring thaw and melting season to date. Speaking to Fargo City leaders during a flood update, Weather Service spokesman Greg Guss says in the third week, the water has been slow to flow and there is a lot of snow left. With that said, Guss says the Red River at Wahpeton may have hit its highest crest for the season.
There's still some snow melt, still some water to come off, still a little bit of a flow in the system, but down at Lake Traverse over at Orwell Dam on the Otter Tail, they were able to shut those down last week and hold off any more releases till that first surge came through. Now they'll be opening up and letting up some more runoff come off from those. But at this point, anything coming in on that tail will likely be much lower than what is coming through Wahpeton right now.
Gus says by the weekend, look at temps in the 40 to 50 degree range. He says this will mean an all-out melt for the Red and its tributaries. West Fargo Mayor Bernie Dardis says they are continually monitoring ice conditions along the Cheyenne River.
When you deal with the Cheyenne River, it's going to be ice jams that's going to be our biggest concern. We have done tours from the Horace Inlet all the way north, north of town, and we're comfortable with that other than the thickness of the ice.
Officials have once again scaled back the potential crest levels along the Red. If the ideal conditions continue, those forecasts could see further revisions. A new probabilistic flood forecast is expected to be delivered later this week. And the House and Senate have now agreed on a pay raise plan for state employees. The plan calls for a 2% raise in the first year of the upcoming biennium. It comes with a minimum of $120 per month increase and a maximum of $200 per month. That would mean a majority of state employees would receive more than 2%, and in the second year, the raise would be 2.5%. Here's House Majority Leader Chet Pollard.
I think it starts us to get towards the end because that was a big, I won't say a wall, but it was a stepping stone. And so that helps us maybe settle. Maybe it's 25 or a third of the appropriations bills without having to go to conference committee, but, you know, because some of those smaller appropriations bills are pretty simple. So that'll help us so we can get down to the real nitty-gritty and the bigger bill and subject matters that we need to deal with.
Conference committees will be appointed this week. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by phone with Max Simon. He is the founder of Greenflower, and that is a group that provides information about medical and recreational marijuana. He joins us from Ojai, California. Max, thanks for being with us today.
Really nice to be here with you.
Why did you start this business?
Well, personally, I have been a medical cannabis patient since I was basically a teenager, even though at that time I didn't realize it because I have a rather severe form of ADD and didn't realize when I started, quite frankly, smoking pot in high school that I was self-medicating. But about 6 or 7 years ago, I did start to really look into understanding the science and the effectiveness of cannabis and how it works in the body and who it works for. And really became shocked that this substance had been actually my most effective treatment for my condition in my lifetime. And yet I really didn't even know that and didn't understand it. And so we created Greenflower to be a trusted source of education, both for consumers, but also for people that want to be a part of the industry.
So that's your corporate mission?
Our mission is really to improve the quality of people's lives through cannabis education. But, you know, we believe that there's so much people don't understand about this plant, and we want to be a place where they can get credible information from experts that's actually helpful and valuable. So that's really our mission.
What's your business model? How do you make a profit and pay people?
We have a subscription service where people can subscribe as a monthly member, and that gives them access to literally thousands of hours of content. We also have online certificate programs where if somebody wants to become an expert at cannabis cultivation or they want to learn how to treat other patients with cannabis and use medical applications, or they want to learn extraction and how you make cannabis oils, we have certificate programs which you can take online that when you complete them, you know, you get a certificate to use for credibility and acknowledgement in the industry.
You have that website, as you mentioned, green-flower.com. There's an awful lot of advocacy out there for cannabis, for health and for leisure use. What claims do you take with a grain of salt? How do you vet the information?
So our experts are who create all of our information for us. And when we work with experts, it is a pretty heavy vetting process. We look at their track record, what they've been doing in the cannabis industry. We ask them more about their knowledge base and interview them in terms of what they do and don't know. We talk to them specifically about what innovation they're bringing forward. And we also kind of dial into what kind of knowledge they can provide to other people that's truly valuable. And so it's a multi-step process of not just vetting people, but making sure that they can also lay out and deliver the information in a way that's truly helpful and valuable. And since we've been doing it for, gosh, almost 6 years now, our network of experts has gotten to be pretty sizable. It covers all countries around the globe, as well as all expertise from, you know, Harvard-trained medical doctors all the way through to PhDs in chemistry who are talking about extraction. So it's been a kind of a lengthy process to get to a place where we really have this nice pool of experts.
And, you know, before Green Flower came about, and for those people who aren't accessing it now, how should people verify claims about the alleged benefits of cannabis?
I think it's tricky. You know, I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I know, as somebody who has now become so knowledgeable about cannabis, that even where I stand, I probably have, you know, 10 to 20% of the knowledge base because of how vast and wide it is. And so I think it's hard. I think that people need to do their own research and do their own understanding and kind of find ways to learn so that they become as competent as they can. And then you can kind of go out into the marketplace and see how those claims hold up. Because that's the biggest thing that I find in cannabis is it's so often I go to a dispensary or a medical establishment and I listen to the people giving the advice and they're wrong a lot of the time. So, that's ultimately the reason why we create a Green Flower is to be a credible source. But I think it's very tricky and I think people are very confused.
Well, it is sometimes like talking to a bartender about how this alcohol might affect me. It seems like
right. A
bit of a curious position to put a salesperson in that role. What research into the substances would you like to see?
Well, there's so much. I mean, the thing that's so unusual about cannabis today is that it's still a federally illegal Schedule I substance, which means that it's in the same classification as heroin and methamphetamines and has no medical value, which is kind of an absurd statement to make because, you know, at this stage of the game, we literally have tens of millions of people who are using it medically every day and telling the government that they're using it medically. But that said, I think, you know, when we talk about research, the first thing that needs to happen is it needs to be descheduled. It needs to be taken off of Schedule One because in that schedule, they're not permitted to do research against something that's a Schedule One substance, besides trying to validate the harms. So once that happens, once that step happens and take place, you know, then I think there's a whole slew of research to be done. And for example, you know, one of the experts on our platform has done a lot of study into cannabis and cancer. And one of the things that's so fascinating with cancer and cannabis is that certain cancers have an unbelievably remarkable response to certain kinds of cannabis profiles, but not others. And so you can understand through some of the research that's been done that, you know, if you have a particular kind of brain tumor and use a particular kind of cannabis with a particular kind of dose, that they're watching cancer cells shrink and oftentimes cancer goes into remission. But when you use different kinds of cannabis or it's a different kind of cancer, then you don't see those same results. And so I think for pretty much every condition that cannabis has been shown anecdotally or in limited clinical studies to be effective, we should do more research. You know, that covers epilepsy and sleep and depression and cancer and anxiety and all those areas where I think cannabinoid medicine shows tremendous promise, but is still done often anecdotally because of the Schedule I ruling.
And there are lots of variations of marijuana. You just referred to the cannabinoid element, the medicinal element that's often cited, and THC, which is the mood-altering element that's often cited. There was recently some research that caught my eye. This was a pretty big story a few weeks ago, a February news story. Smoking cannabis as a teenager could increase the risk of depression in adulthood by almost 40%. This was a study by Oxford University in the United Kingdom. Did you follow up on any of that?
I didn't see that one because there was another study that came out recently that was saying that cannabis was linked to psychosis.
Yes.
And I looked much more deeply into that one and could respond to that, but I didn't hear about the Oxford study.
Well, react to the psychosis one.
So basically what they did with that study is they actually were tracking people that had been diagnosed with psychosis, and they found that people that had psychosis were three times more likely to be self-medicating with cannabis than people that weren't. So that was actually what the study showed, is that people with psychosis were more likely to self-medicate. But where the story became kind of distorted intentionally was that cannabis was causing the psychosis. And the reason why that argument is invalid is that cannabis use has really been skyrocketing exponentially over the last few decades. There's no other way to say that. That we've had, you know, a multiple 100% increase in cannabis use, but the rise of psychosis has not had any effect. And so the hypothesis would be, you know, if you think of it logically, well, if cannabis caused psychosis, then with the exceptional rise, the dramatic rise in cannabis use, we would also see a clinical rise in psychosis. But that's not actually been the case. Psychosis has stayed flatline in terms of a diagnosed behavior. And so it's another example, and this happens pretty frequently, of where small studies are done with the intent of proving harm. They're not being done with the intent of proving scientific validity. They're being funded to prove harm. And so they make some generalized conclusions or assumptions that don't actually hold up under any scientific scrutiny, and that was one example of them.
A lot of times when you go into a medical or a recreational marijuana shop, you'll see labels on the products that indicate the percentage of whatever active ingredients you're looking into. Isn't it also the truth that these days there are strains of marijuana that are far more potent than they would have been a generation ago?
Absolutely, way more potent. And I don't think we know yet or understand yet what the implications of that stronger potency is, and I think it's another area that needs to be studied. I'll tell you personally, and that's sometimes all you can rest back into in these some of these conversations, that I've been what you would consider a heavy cannabis user for many decades now. Like I said, I have been self-medicating every day for ADD for many decades now, and personally, I don't see any negative implications of using this plant consistently for many, many years. I absolutely feel a net positive effect that I can stand behind personally as somebody that believes this is a safe plant.
Let's delve into some of the legal aspects here. Generations after Prohibition, you can still buy white lightning in some parts of the country. It's still produced and sold illegally. How has marijuana legalization affected illegal sales?
It's done both things, and I say both, meaning it certainly has in states where legalization has happened. You've seen an uptake in those regulated markets. You've seen tax revenue go up. You've seen a bunch of new adopters, particularly baby boomers, start to get involved in cannabis. And so there's been a new demographic and a new population that's been both adopted and protected. They also say that in legal markets, teen use drops significantly because they don't have a way to get access to it as easily as when there's not a legal regulated system. At the same time, in places like California, where the regulated market kind of trampled on top of an existing regulated framework that was a little bit looser and not quite as highly regulated, has seen an incredible uptake in the amount of black market cannabis sold. And that's because this new regulated market is overly taxed and overly regulated, and it makes it very difficult for producers to operate in any kind of way that doesn't require, you know, quite frankly, tens of millions of dollars. And as a result of that, I think a lot of people have gone back to the black market in order to purchase their cannabis. And so, you know, as your point in the beginning of this conversation, it's highly fragmented, which does create quite a bit of problems. And, you know, I think it'll just continue to take time to iron those things out.
Well, let's chat a bit about these taxes. Liquor and cigarette taxes are sometimes referred to as sin taxes. And they're advocated as a way to raise the price of something and maybe reduce sales by virtue of that. How would you describe taxes on marijuana sales?
Well, I mean, I think there's how you classify them, right? Where you're right, they still kind of put these taxes, these very high taxes on cannabis, because they put them in the same classification as alcohol and cigarettes. But partially what's also happening is that just there's a funny system with cannabis where most of the time, I think it's almost all the time, you're regulated both at a state level and a local level. And so what happens is the state has a certain amount of taxes that they put on it, which is already pretty high, you know, upwards of 25 to 40% in many cases. And then you tack on local taxes who are seeing an opportunity to generate additional tax revenue from this new kind of classification. And so, you know, whether you call it a sin tax or you just call it cannabis being overtaxed, you know, oftentimes these companies are paying well upwards of 40%, but sometimes even high, you know, 50, 55% just in tax revenue because of the local and state regulatory framework.
Has law enforcement in states adjacent to legal sales states adapted to the likelihood of a controlled substance being transferred through their jurisdictions?
I think that you see it in different places in different ways. You know, I can't remember which state it was, but I do remember in 2018, a state sued Colorado because they, I don't know where they got this information, but they created some report that showed that illegal cannabis was crossing straight lines from Colorado into their state. Now, I do believe that got thrown out. I didn't follow up on that, so I'm not the most credible source there, but I think it's an issue, you know, and I think ultimately what needs to happen is we need to move away from this state regulatory act and really move into more of a federally nationwide regulated system, because a lot of these challenges are created by the system in which they operate. And if we just change the system a little bit, I think it would actually make everything a little bit more valuable.
Max Simon is the founder of Greenflower. This is an online information service which also offers some educational programs for a fee, and that includes these law and business certificate courses. What are the liability issues associated with legal sales of cannabis products?
Oh, man, there's so many. when you say liability issues, you can tackle that from almost every direction. You know, most employers still drug test, even if it's medically legal. And so there's this, it's almost a crisis happening, an employment crisis, where, you know, even in medically permitted places, people are failing drug tests, but they're, you know, legally permitted to consume. And so there's that regulatory issue. There's the licensing framework between local and state that's an issue. There's the fact that oftentimes they give out limited licenses. And so there's the application process and how you get approved and move through the application process. And then, of course, there's all the criminal liability. If you don't operate in compliance or you break compliance rules, you know, for example, in Colorado, there was just a pretty big scandal where retail employees, so, you know, nothing at management level, nothing at the owner level, retail employees were basically selling excessive cannabis to people beyond the limits of what was legally permitted.
Overserving?
And those people, yeah, exactly. They were overserving, essentially. And that brought them down. You know, that took the whole thing down. And so there's rules upon rules upon rules upon rules around how they're trying to regulate this. And it is very difficult to operate in compliance in this marketplace that's changing all the time.
I have relatives in Washington State, and I've noticed when I drive out to see them, wow, there are a lot of shops. In states with legal,
everywhere,
recreational, and medical marijuana, a lot of these businesses have opened, competing for customers. How would you distinguish the vendors most likely to be successful?
Well, I think that ultimately it does come back to the same metrics that any other normal business would adhere to. You know, are they carrying and supplying good products? Are their staff well educated? Is their pricing reasonable? You know, very common kind of economic factors that make business successful still apply to cannabis. They're just more challenging to figure out. But ultimately, I think that the companies that are in this for the right reasons will withstand the ups and downs of changing regulations and changing frameworks. And I do believe, because we're seeing it, the amount of opportunity for people to, whether it's to create wealth or it's to create an empire or it's to make an impact, is quite significant in the cannabis movement. And so I think, you know, people need to be successful. You just need to be committed to doing it for the right reasons and be willing to stay in it a little bit longer than you probably expected to.
I found out a bit about your organization from Bloomberg News. They have a filing up there for you. Also, there's this move toward listing cannabis-producing organizations on stock exchanges. What sort of a business opportunity is this for people?
It's enormous. It's not easy, I'll tell you that much, because you've really got to understand what makes these businesses successful and what will make these businesses successful. And I can tell you that a lot of retail investors are not making good bets. They're making bets based upon things they don't really understand. But that said, if you do your research and you understand, you know, what the cannabis industry is developing into, I have a lot of friends that have already become millionaires just by making really smart, sizable bets in cannabis stocks early enough to where as they hit and they go to, you know, billion-dollar valuations, you all of a sudden have a really nice opportunity. So I think it's a sizable opportunity, but it requires more research and more education than you would think is necessary for something like this.
Well, your greenflower.com offers this academy, which has a number of different educational routes that people can take for a few hundred to over $1,000 perhaps. I don't suspect you are accredited yet, but how do you look at the value of having a certificate from Greenflower?
I think there's a few reasons why we have gone down this path. One, there is no accreditation body, and there's nobody that's credible enough to be an accrediting body in cannabis. And so we've taken that responsibility very seriously, and we've been developing and building curriculum and subject matter experts that are quality enough that the moment some accreditation body comes online, that we could submit and subsequently be approved for. So one, you know, people just need to, quite frankly, validate for themselves that the quality of education is as good as it is. But also, you know, I think that the value of these things are that people don't know anything. You know, the process of growing cannabis is about 1,000 times more complicated than people would think it is.
All right.
It's really difficult. I don't know if you've ever done it, but I've done it a bunch of times now, and it's really hard. And so the knowledge that you get in these different targeted areas is invaluable in terms of understanding how to participate in these areas. And without it, you just don't really have much of a shot of getting ahead.
Max Simon is the founder of Greenflower. You can find out more at green-flower.com. Max, thanks for joining us today.
It was a real pleasure. You had phenomenal questions.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming, along with our members and other sources, here on Prairie Public.
Shen Yun presents 5,000 Years of Civilization, combining ancient legends with technological innovations, historically authentic costumes, and storytelling. Through classical Chinese dance, Shen Yun shares diverse ethnic and folk traditions filled with orchestral sound. May 5th at the Chester Fritz Auditorium in Grand Forks. One performance only. Tickets at shenyun.com. shenyun.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 2nd. North Dakotans anxiously await signs of spring after a long winter. The snow melts. Days grow longer. But one sign of spring that is not appreciated is the emergence of pests that have been dormant under the snow. One of the more common of these pests is the pocket gopher. The Grand Forks Herald noted that battling pocket gophers is a rite of spring. The Yankton Press and Dakotan says that pocket gophers send shivers up and down the spines of landowners. On this date in 1912, Burleigh County lawmakers announced a program to address the gopher problem, a bounty of 1 cent for each gopher killed. Intrepid gopher hunters were instructed to bring gopher tails to their local township clerks. The clerks would fill out the necessary paperwork and pay the bounty. The pocket gopher gets its name from the fur-lined pouch on each side of its mouth. They are very common throughout North Dakota and neighboring states. But it's likely that the bounty also included ground squirrels, with no distinction being made for the difference. Either one can destroy crops in several ways. They sometimes uproot plants and pull them into their tunnels. They also feed on the plants above ground and even forage on the roots below ground. These pests are especially fond of alfalfa. They like to live near gardens, where they can dig tunnels and have access to root vegetables like carrots. Farmers and gardeners can spot the presence of gophers by the mounds of dirt at the tunnel openings. Since they range from 5 inches to 14 inches long, they are considered a small rodent. But for a small animal, they can do a great deal of damage, and not only to crops. They can also destroy underground utility cables and irrigation pipes. Burleigh County's solution to the problem was not unique. Many counties across the Great Plains offered a gopher bounty, and many still do. In 1912, Burleigh County insisted that the bounty would be paid only on gophers killed in that county, but the commissioners did not say just how they would determine where the gopher tails came from. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The latest surge of migrants has U.S. authorities holding families outdoors and fenced in.
We have third world processing under a bridge. I never thought that in my own city I would have people under the bridge, homeless.
Are border officials helping the humanitarian crisis or making it worse? David Green reports from El Paso on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, Eric Buren is a history professor at UND, and you'll hear his conversation with John Harris about the book he edited, Protesting on Bended Knee, Race, Dissent, and Patriotism in 21st Century America. And Jerry Rossberg played football for NDSU, eventually joining the NFL as a special teams coach. We'll share his discussion with Prairie Public's Eric Detheridge. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.